Hey, before we get started, I want to let you know that our annual Max Fun Drive starts a week from today. It's the one time of year we come to you and we give you things and we ask for your support. We have some amazing brand new thank you gifts this year and bonus content, a special episode just for members starring our listeners. We turn the microphone to you and I think you'll find it very useful. But the best thing we can give you is the satisfaction that you made Depresh Mode available to the whole world. We rely on our listener membership in order to exist and get this show out in the world where it can help people. Much more about Max Fun Drive next week when the drive commences. It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. I've said that 100 times. It is the 100th episode of Depresh Mode, 100 episodes in less than 2 years. It's been a busy time, so we thought it would be a good moment to take a brief pause, grab a breath, center ourselves, and reflect. When I talk to people about making Depresh Mode, there's often a question that I get asked, and it's a question that trips me up every time. Who has been your favorite guest, people say? And it trips me up because I don't have one. I tend to just mumble something about, they're all pretty good, and then desperately attempt to change the subject. Because there are so many to choose from, I can't narrow it down. It's like a 100-way tie for my favorite. Same thing happens when I'm asked what my favorite episodes have been. I'll sometimes say, the first one with Patton Oswalt was good, and then all the rest of them were good too. Or I'll say whatever the most recent one was because it's top of mind. It's very, very hard for me to answer these questions. But I do think a fair question is, what episodes, plural, have stayed with you the longest? What are the ones that you keep thinking about? So I thought, yeah, fair play. Maybe that's something we could do today on this, our 100th episode. I'm here with Depresh Mode producer Gabe Mara. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, John.
And, you know, I have issued this challenge to you as well as to myself to pick 5 favorite episodes. How did you do with your process?
Oh, boy. Let's see. Looking back through all of our episodes, I wanted to pick ones that like you said, stuck with me, but also surprised me. So that's why I have some of the less glamorous episodes, but ones where I had to stop and think, and I listened back, and I enjoyed the listen through. And you know, you get them every time, John.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I went through all 100 episodes, and I started off with a list of about 20, 25, and then I started making cuts. It was like a chorus line or the tryouts for the baseball team or something.
Sure.
Pick your milieu, and started whittling it down. And some of the cuts were kind of agonizing, but I did tell myself, it's okay. They're all in the archive. They're all on our show pages. People can go back and listen to whatever it is they want. But yeah, I picked some that I found myself talking to other people about the most, you know, whether it's my family or my friends or, you know, on the phone with my mom, just saying like, oh yeah, you know, we talked about this and then he said this and I really, you know, that was an amazing story and what was really surprising. And so I kind of settled on the ones that were living rent-free in my head for the longest.
Like the kids say.
And so yeah, I think I went for some of the bigger celebrity names and you went for some of the deeper cuts.
Yes.
So I figured what we would do is alternate, and we will each go in order from the oldest episode that we have to the newest episode that we have. Sort of a chronological journey through the history of the show.
Yes, and I will definitely not spruce up the audio of the older episodes to make it sound even cleaner.
Okay, good. Yeah, it's you'll capture my microphone problems in all their glory. Yeah, yeah.
Good times, John.
We've come a long way in microphone placement, I think. All right, who's batting leadoff for you?
Sure. First of all, my first pick chronologically is episode 19. It is Chelsea Ursin, The episode is called Depression, Anxiety, and Devil Horns. Chelsea Ursin Saves Your Soul with Rock and Roll. So I know Chelsea Ursin. Luckily for me, I got to know her through Maximum Fun, through podcasting, because her podcast, Dear Young Rocker, was one of the best podcasts I'd heard in many, many years. It's like a memoir and a series of letters written back and forth to herself about self-abuse and rock music and depression and, you know, hating yourself.
And we'll listen to some of it now. Why is the music scene so sexist and full of creeps?
Because the world is.
Are they laid more bare and obvious in music, though?
Yeah, because, I mean, men had such a monopoly, at least publicly, on rock music for so long that, you know, it was always a thing like a guy could pick up a guitar and then the girls would like him, right? So then when a girl picks up a guitar, uh-oh, she gets a little bit of power. He was, you know, the guys were supposed to be the ones with the power to rock and then have the girls fawn over them. And so I thought about this a lot. So I think, you know, in an episode of my podcast recently, I had a writer, a guest memoirist, write that she found out in high school that boys get very upset if a girl picks up a guitar and doesn't ask them for advice on how to play it. If she's like, I'm just going to bash on this thing. And you'll see that in comments on, you know, social media posts. I follow just like hashtag musician. And sometimes, you know, like the other day, a video of a woman playing a guitar came up. And yeah, she wasn't the world's best guitarist, but I think it was like a talent show or something. She was just like, okay, yeah, I can play the guitar. And all these comments from these guys, like, disgusting. Just like, if you're going to play that guitar, you better learn your whatever scales and you better tune it right and learn how to set your amp settings. And they're so upset. It's like, she didn't say I'm the world's best guitarist. This video is not framed in that way at all. But just for the fact that she's a woman playing a guitar, like if a guy just picked up a guitar and crappily played, no one would care. They wouldn't comment on it. They'd be like, okay, the guy sucks. So there's just something so threatening to them about it. And I think they know that we just look cooler doing it. Sorry. Like, I think women just look cooler playing music. So I think that's what it is.
So I really like this episode, John, that it was a very personal pick for me, that Chelsea's about my age. And, you know, I find myself often a little bit starstruck when we have some of our more famous guests. Mm-hmm. I play it cool. But she is someone that I felt like I knew and was also within my age group, basically. And she felt familiar. And also, I was in awe of her and her honesty and her music and everything. So I was really glad we got to have her on the show and that you had such a great talk with her.
It was a talk I really remember a lot. And it's a talk that our Facebook group, Preshies, a lot of people talked about it there, too. It's interesting for me as somebody who follows music really closely, has always followed music really closely, and I'm not so young, so it's been going on for a long time. As somebody who plays in a dad band, I play in a band that does, you know, bars around the Twin Cities, that kind of thing.
Hell yeah.
You know, and this, the power dynamics and the mental health dynamics are something that I don't spend a lot of time thinking about, because I'm in such a privileged position, being like, you know, an older dude playing music in bars, white dude playing music in bars. So like all of that, I was blissfully unaware of all my privilege, and Chelsea really laid it bare in a really tight way.
I love it.
All right. We'll move forward a little bit here from episode 19 with Chelsea to episode 44. This is Amanda Knox on the difference between exoneration and freedom. Now, Amanda Knox is a name that if you paid attention to the news in recent years, you might be familiar with. This is the college student from Seattle who was studying in Italy. Her roommate in the study abroad apartment that she was living in was murdered, and Amanda was accused of the crime and put on trial and convicted, and there was a lot of appeals, and ultimately she was exonerated of the crime of murdering her roommate. It's really horrible. And, you know, it was improbable, I think, how we came to book her. I just suddenly noticed one day that she was following me on on Twitter, and I knew that we had some friends in common back in Seattle. I'm from Seattle. She lives there now. And so I took my gamble. I rolled my dice and invited her on the show. And I think she was already familiar with the show. And she said, yeah, I'd love to come on and talk about it. What really interested me was her experiences with trauma. And this is something that I've really altered my thinking after hosting this show and The Hilarious World of Depression, the show I did before, about the long-term effects of trauma. I always thought of it as just like, oh yeah, some bad things happen, and then you're glad that they're not happening anymore, and then you move on. But it's the attempt to process the trauma that really creates a lot of long-term effects. And Amanda had this story that I must have told, you know, when people say, oh, who have you had on the show that's been really exciting? I'm like, well, Amanda Knox was on, and she told this story about going to the movies.
I remember going like maybe a year or so after I was released from prison. I was invited to go to the Seattle International Film Festival and to see an Italian film. And I went to watch the Italian film. I was a little bit nervous not because it was an Italian film, but because I was going to be in a room full of strangers. I was not in a space at that point of feeling comfortable around people I didn't know. So just being in public in general was one of those ways that my trauma manifested itself. I just, for a long, long time, did not feel comfortable in public and did not feel comfortable, especially in public crowds. I still feel uncomfortable with that to this day. And I went to this theater thinking, okay, it's going to be a dark room. We're all watching a movie. No one's going to be looking at me. I sit down. I start watching the film. I discover that the film is in Napoletano dialect. And Napoletano dialect is a very like classic dialect in Italy. It's what you would hear in like classic sort of lounge singery, like schmoozy songs. Like those are often in a Napoletano dialect. But my exposure to Napoletano dialect was exclusive to prison. When I was living in Perugia, I never talked to anyone who used Napoletano dialect. But there were lots of people in prison who spoke with Napoletano dialect. And so when I started hearing that dialect in the film, and particularly when I heard the phrase affacciati, which is what the guards or other prisoners would say to me to come to the cell door, it means like affacciati means like face me, basically, like, you know, show your face. And that I had only ever heard that within the context of me having to go up to the bars of my cell to respond to someone who was asking to see me. And I had an immediate panic attack. I started hyperventilating. I started feeling really claustrophobic, and I had to leave the theater because I couldn't handle it.
The past matters. I sometimes am called upon to give speeches about mental health, and I try to boil things down to a few simple points of things that I've learned over the course of doing the work that I've been doing, that we've been doing. And always on my list of bullet points is the past matters. And so, you know, I admire Amanda so deeply that she could come on this show and talk about such a vulnerable time. And it's really informative too, because I think a lot of people thought, well, she's exonerated, then she just lets out a big sigh of relief and carries on with her day.
But she gets Miller time.
No, but it's still going on.
It was a harrowing episode, like listening to it, that even listening back to that clip, she went through so much, and she's still going through it. People are still on her about it. And I remember when you said that we got Amanda Knox on the show, I stopped and thought, huh, so we got like your lawyer, a friend of yours named Amanda? Okay, that's cool. And then when I realized you met Amanda Knox, I like was blown away. I was like, oh my gosh, we're going to speak to her. This is what an event for us.
Yeah, it was really remarkable. All right, you're next up. Who do you got? What number do you have?
Coming up next for me, I have episode 26. It is Jackie Cation Did What You Should Do. Jackie is another veteran of Maximum Fun and an excellent comedian. This one really stuck with me for reasons I can't even really explain. That Jackie is like a scrapper, that she just radiates toughness. And she really opened up really well in this episode talking to you about her broken family life and everything. I still think about a phrase she dropped later on in the episode where she gets thrown out of a bar for fighting a customer and she says, "Red card on Cation." Love that. But, you know, it was a great conversation, and I really wasn't familiar with her beforehand, and I just really, really loved the episode.
It's probably one of the reasons why I don't have Comedy Central, you know, specials and stuff like that, where I'm just sort of grinding it out, and I have fans, and people like my stand-up, and it's all well and good, but it is not superstardom. It is not even, you know, Netflix special stardom. So, but it's because I spent most of my life trying not to be, because if you were noticed, you were in the way. If you were way, you were a problem. There was hitting, there was shouting, and there was put you to work. There were things that I've avoided my entire life. And then there is the anxiety, the sort of, you could tell people who have been hit in different ways. They're sort of like dogs, right? People, you know, and we're not that different from dogs, except for that dogs have one way of telling you that they're not happy. And that is to sort of snap at you. And they're just like, "Get off of me or I will bite you." But that was to an earlier point. But what I'm talking about now is that I got hit so much when I was a kid that when someone would threaten to hit me when I was later in life until I got therapy, I'd be like, I would literally get in their face as if to say, "You think I've never been hit? Fuck you. I could take a punch," you know, and which would usually make the other person back down.
Oof. Talk about raw and trauma and just,
yeah. It's a tough listen, and it was a tough episode, but
has the happy ending though. It goes into her finding love and everything, but you know, she reminds me of like a Mark Wahlberg movie. You know, she's tough of heart, and you know, I root for Jackie Cation.
And the past matters. Really, therapy matters so much, and treatment, like, it's, you know, even beyond scheduling an appointment with a therapist and going in and talking, but addressing what has happened to you, and it doesn't make it go away. It doesn't make the pain go away, but it's so inspirational, all that she had to deal with, and then how she set a course for how she was going to deal with it.
Yes.
And what she was going to do going forward.
Super cool.
Super cool. At number four, I went with one of the bigger names, and this is our episode number 71, Jamie Lee Curtis, Self-Professed Dope Fiend of Show-Off Business. And that title refers to a couple of terms that Jamie uses. One, she uses the term show-off business instead of show business because she feels it's more honest for the kind of showiness of show-off business. And I wanted to follow up on another term that she had used. The other term that stood out for me is when you talk about your history with addiction, you use the term dope fiend.
Yeah. Look at you, like, finding my repetitive phrasing.
Hey, man, I do my research.
I say I'm a dope fiend because I want to destigmatize and demystify the term addict to minimize my addiction is very easy to do. And I have to remind myself all the time that my addiction to opiates is no different than the person who is jonesing for fentanyl on the street today. So I like to refer to myself in that same way as a dope fiend because it makes it a little less fun and a little less glamorous.
Yeah. It's circumstances of your life happen to be that your addiction takes place in your world and not their world.
Right. And it's important to me, very important to me, that I represent whatever version of truth I can represent, I need to represent it. It's very important to me that people don't look up to me as anything other than a human being who is trying, just like other people, to navigate all of this complex emotional, physical, spiritual, political world, show business world, show off business world, and that I am struggling with it just like everybody else.
I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is, as we record this, she's up for an Oscar for Everything Everywhere All at Once. By the time
Incredible performance,
hot dog fingers. By the time this episode comes out, we'll know whether she's won. But I mean, just this brutal honesty about herself, where she didn't need to do this. You know, we're not CNN. We're not whatever E! Entertainment News, whatever it is. Like, we're not part of the Hollywood press corps. But she felt so strongly about putting herself out there and showing her vulnerability and showing her flaws in an effort to help other people that it was really an inspiration.
I was positively starstruck. She liked my dog. it was just amazing of her to just share so bluntly all these things with us, which I was just floored, starstruck.
Yeah, I tried to get her back on like a month later to talk about the next Halloween movie, but I was told, no, come on, you had her on once, don't get greedy.
Yeah, that's her busy season, I'm sure, where yes. she books all of her things around that month.
Yeah, the anecdote I always tell from that one too is, I asked her about her mother, Janet Leigh, from the movie Psycho, and whether the rumors are true that Janet Leigh would only take baths after that movie forever. And Jamie said, you know, she was in one movie where she got stabbed. And I've had people coming after me with knives for 40 years worth of movies.
Yeah, nobody asks about the Robert Mitchum Christmas movie?
No, apparently not. Apparently not. But
it's a good one.
It was a good one. Jamie was fantastic. It's Depression Mode's 100th episode, and we're recalling some of the first 99 episodes that really stayed with us. We'll have more after the break.
Carrying 3 beef and dairy all day.
Max Fun Drive. Hey, Chef, we got another one.
Another Max Fun Drive. People know it's the best time to support the shows they love. You tell them how Meetup Day is back?
Sure did. They wanted to know about the live streams, though.
Those are finishing up right now. We can even send one out on the first night, March 20th.
March 20th, Chef!
I'll give them a heads up. They also wanted the limited time thank you gifts for new and upgrading members.
Yep, and we got some fresh episodes ready to go too.
All right, we got exciting live streams, Meetup Day, fresh episodes, limited time gifts. Oh, and BOCO.
Yeah, okay, let them know that Max Fun Drive 2023 will be ready on March 20th, and it'll only be 2 weeks.
2 weeks, Chef!
Max Fun Drive starts on March 20th for just 2 weeks. No problem.
Order up!
Shoot, I forgot their water.
Continuing now with some of the most memorable episodes of Depression Mode, I'm John Moe, here with our show's producer, Gabe Mara.
All right, my next one, I think unsurprisingly for probably everyone, is the video game episode. It is episode...
Your baby.
My baby is... episode. Your baby. It was episode 33, The Beautiful World of Mentally Nutritious Video Games. I just... Obviously, I'm a very big fan of video gaming. It's what I do in most of my free time. And combining it with mental health stuff. You know, the emergence of mental health in video games has been really wonderful to see. And, you know, I appreciated that you... let me indulge myself. And it also turned out to be a fun episode that one of my favorite podcasts on Maximum Fun is Triple Click. And we got the very excellent and brilliant Maddie Myers from that show to comment on her video gaming. But I ended up picking a clip here with the interview with Greg Lobanov, the man who created the video game Chicory, which is all about a little dog painting and your friend the rabbit who is very seriously depressed and burned out. The tonal shift is jarring and also very lovely.
Your best friend in this game is somebody who is struggling a lot. And you as the main character are somebody who kind of has to learn to I don't know, help that person, learn how to help that person, how to be that person's friend, even though they're going through something that's really tough.
I was going to say I've never made a game, but I did make some very, very bad text-based adventure games on an Apple IIe when I was 13 that I'm convinced are worse than anything that you made. I know this for a fact. But I've written books, and that's a lot of work. And yet making games, the kind that you make, seems harder to me than even writing books. Like the enormous amount of work that goes into it. How do you make something that motivates you so much that you'd be willing to put in that work? Like, are you driven to make this illustration game? Are you driven to address these mental health things? Like, what is it that you wanted to get across so badly that it's worth it?
Huh. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so on one level, like I really, really enjoy the process. I think that is like one of my saving graces. And I enjoy a challenge. Previously, like I once went on like a cross-country bike trip. Like I rode on my bicycle for a few months across the country. I just start doing things where I don't know if I can actually do it. I think this game actually was sort of part of it. Like at the beginning of this game, the basic premise of it's a game where you use drawing to color the world in or whatever. There was a question like, can I make a game where the main thing you do is draw? And I didn't even know if that was possible. Like I've never played a game that was like that, and I didn't know if that was even going to work. and so like it started from that simple question, and then as soon as you find one answer, more questions come up, and then you know you start developing a story, and things get really complicated. And it really did get complicated. I mean, like, the story went to places that we did not anticipate, I think, at the outset. Along the way, every one of the steps is fun. And then, yeah, before you know it, I've made this thing. And I look back and I'm like, I don't even know how I if yeah. I had known at the beginning how crazy it was going to be by the end, like, I don't know if I would have, you know, started.
Have you gone on to do any more gaming or Apple II writing, John?
No, the Apple IIe is still in the shop. But, you know, a lot of what we talk about on the show, people said, well, you talk about art a lot. You talk about creativity a lot. And that's true, you know, because we have some names that are pretty well known. But I also think there's just something so beautiful about a human attempt at expression in what can be a cold world. And that's what really impressed me about this whole episode is this glimpse into the beautiful art making that goes into the video games and the sensitivity of it.
It's a really wonderful thing to see art transform into something different that, you know, when I was growing up, there weren't any video games about melancholy. It was, no. You know, jumping and getting coins. Right. And now there are very thoughtful games about what it means to be human, about what it means to suffer a loss and everything. It's a brave new world, John.
It's beautiful. All right.
What's your next pick, John?
I've got Kevin Love. And this is like, I don't know, this is sort of a Moby Dick kind of situation. he was our white whale for a long time. I had been in touch with Kevin since before we started doing this show about, hey, I'm about to have a show again. Will you come on and be a guest? Of course I will. And then, you know, it turns out the life of an NBA player is an awfully busy one. Kevin
what?
Is a, I know, you kind of dribbling basketballs and such. and Kevin is a multi-year veteran, goes back, I think, 14 years in the league now, something
wow.
like that. Yeah, he was with the Cleveland Cavaliers when we spoke to him. He has since joined the Miami Heat. I follow him closely because he's the only basketball player I know personally. And he's got a remarkable story. He is someone who has experienced depression, anxiety, and notably, and this is when he really broke his public silence about it, a panic attack during a game against the Atlanta Hawks that was pretty devastating.
I think we start out the season like, I don't know, you can look back like maybe like 3-7, and we're losing to the Hawks who, yeah, 2 years prior to that were, you know, a top few seed in the Eastern Conference, but we're losing to them at halftime. Seems like things are going, you know, very, very wrong. You know, I'm stressed out, high anxiety. I think we're getting beat by maybe double digits going into halftime, and
untreated anxiety really at this point
yeah.
too, right?
No, for yeah. sure. Untreated and something that I was just like, this is just life. This is just what I'm going to have to live with and deal with. So I better come to terms with it. But it got to a point, yeah, where right after halftime, we had called the first time out. They probably scored a couple straight baskets. Atlanta did. And that's when I just felt my heart rate just, you know, go from just over 100 to, you know, I felt like 200.
Oh my God.
180 or 190, whatever my max is, you know, like I just, my heart started beating. I couldn't catch my breath. I feel like I'm having a cardiac type episode. I tell my coach, starts talking to me. I remove myself from the huddle. He comes over like, what the hell is wrong? And then I just bail to the locker room. I'm like trying to find a place where I can either lay down. I don't know what the hell I'm looking for. I'm like, is this it?
I'm like, do I die?
Yeah, on the if this is it, game, where do I want to be seen? You know, am I pulling the shirt over my face like Caesar did so they can't see my last face? But I end up on the floor of our head athletic trainer's office and just have, full blown attack right there.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Like you said with Jimmy Lee Curtis, it's amazing. He doesn't have to do this.
No.
He doesn't have to open up. He doesn't have to share. He doesn't have to make a difference. And he chooses to. And his honesty is so refreshing.
Yeah, he has. I mean, it's not just that he has nothing to gain. He has everything to lose. You know, there are very, very few spots available at that level of athletics playing for that kind of money. And to show any kind of vulnerability is really risky. But
do you think people like on the court like trash talk him about it? And he's just don't worry about it. I embrace you.
It's been the opposite. And it's been like Kevin is someone I point to as like a real shift, not just in sports, but in society. Because I think 10 years ago, 5 years ago, somebody like that doesn't come forward and talk about an event like that. And if they do, everybody else gets away from them as quickly as possible. Mm. But when he came out and talked about that, you know, LeBron James stepped up and said, hey, you know, we got to support him. And this happens to all sorts of people. And then all sorts of other players in basketball and in other sports started stepping forward and saying, yeah, I deal with this too. You saw baseball players start taking time away, you know, going on the injured list for their mental health. It reached a point where it was so common that it wasn't even much of a story anymore. Like the banality of it. Yeah, the banality of it was the triumph when it just became so commonplace. And it wasn't when Kevin started talking about that. So yeah, I became a Cleveland Cavaliers fan after that episode, which was episode 78, by the way, Kevin Love, all-star in the NBA and in destigmatization. One of my wonderful overly wordy headlines for episodes. And now I'm a Miami Heat fan, and I'll continue to follow Kevin for as long as he plays.
Yeah, score for the good guys.
Absolutely. All right, you got some poetry coming up next in your number two slot.
I do. We have Shane Kozan. It is episode 70. Shane Kozan says, sometimes bullying is just assault. Mm. I'm not a big poetry fan. It's something that I've never quite understood my whole life. But, you know, I know good poetry when I hear it or I read it.
Sure.
And having this conversation with Shane, who's someone I'd never heard of before, and I believe you put it even in the show description, that after he read the poem that concludes the episode, we were just completely speechless. It was a masterful piece of poetry. I was going to pick it for this, just the whole long poem for here, but I thought, you know, you can, listeners, lovely listeners, you can just listen to the episode. It's at the end of it, and I wouldn't want to spoil it for you. It's just a wonderful piece.
Look that
but
one
the
up.
Other, yes, the other great thing he does, as many poets do, is he has many great metaphors for how a depression feels. And that's why I picked this clip.
I remember somebody asked me, how do you describe depression? And it caught me off guard because I was like, I don't really know if I can describe it. But then, you know, I ended up writing this very short sort of scribbled down thing on a piece of, maybe it was a napkin, I don't know. And I called it Circle, and it was the best way I could sort of try to describe it to people. And all it said was, if you keep your eye on depression, then back away, spacing yourself farther and farther, but all the while watching depression shrink in the growing distance. When that tiny speck of sadness vanishes from sight completely, It's at that precise moment your periphery will see hands reaching up from behind you to cover your eyes, and you will hear a small voice whisper, "Guess who?" It felt like it was always that sort of thing that was, as soon as it was gone, it was right back.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. Like I've been hosting this show and shows like this for many years. I've written a book about depression. I still couldn't really describe it to people. I don't know anybody. Like, you can come up with imagery around it, and certainly you can come up with very strong imagery around it. But like, what we can talk about what it's like, but it's so hard to talk about what it actually is.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have trouble describing it, especially to people who haven't endured it before. There's a lot of people who just don't understand it. They haven't had to live with it. There are certainly times where those people get depressed, but they don't deal with it on the constant basis that it's this thing that you keep throwing. It's a boomerang. You keep throwing it away and it keeps coming back. All you want for is it to go away for a long, long time. But for whatever reason, for you, it keeps coming back and it can just sort of haunt you. And there's not a good way to let people know this is what it's like. You can't, it's not like trying to describe, you know, a plate of food. You can't say, well, it tastes like chicken. It doesn't actually. It tastes like something you never want to eat again, but it's always on the menu.
Shane talks so eloquently about bullying too, and about the bullying he experienced. And as the title of the episode alludes to, like, it's, he was assaulted, you know, and it wasn't cute, and it wasn't, you know, a funny story about how tough it is growing up, but then he turned out okay. Like, he got messed up. I remember he told a story about being bullied on the bus and somebody saying, you know, one of these guys coming up and saying, "Do you want to die?" And he responds by saying, "Sometimes." And it kind of shut the guy down. Like, he continued to bully him, but not ask that question anymore.
Yeah, it got too real for the bully.
It got too real. All right. Well, I'm coming in at my number two with, again, I'm going for the big names. I'm glad you took the deep cuts, because I went for the star-studded journey. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. And I remember you just, like, emailed his office and they wrote back and said, okay.
Yeah. Goes to show you, listeners, sometimes you ask and you do receive. It's wild.
Sometimes you just knock on the front door and they answer and it's okay. But he was there to talk mostly about burnout and like how employers can change their workplace to make it a more mentally healthy place. I almost put Jennifer Moss on our list, who we've had talking about burnout a couple of times, which has become such an issue all over society, really. But I included Dr. Murthy here because he talked about social media. And, you know, I write a newsletter on Substack for the show once a week, comes out on Mondays. And when I go through news stories again and again and again, like, I look at the youth mental health crisis and how much of it is being pegged to the rise of social media. And he had some really intelligent thoughts on that subject.
And even though you know that people are curating their images, that they're doctoring their photos, they're only posting like the best parts sometimes of what's happening in their life, still it can leave many people feeling worse off. But for many kids also, it is overtaking and edging out, if you will, the in-person interactions that they have with, you know, in their life, which are so absolutely essential to developing a strong and healthy mental health and well-being. And so there are other reasons as well that we need to be concerned about when it comes to tech, including the fact that these platforms are often designed to pull our kids in and keep them on the platforms. They're not necessarily designed for time well spent. They're designed for just time spent.
Sticky, I think they call it.
Yeah. You have some of the best designers in the world, you know, and technologists who are creating these platforms. And how is a 14, 15-year-old child supposed to summon all of the willpower in the world to fight off and fend off these very well-developed and designed platforms and algorithms that are designed for primary reason of pulling people in and maximizing time spent? So this is not a fair fight, if you will. And right now, the problem we have, John, is that, you know, I'll tell you, in my house, the vast majority of products that I use and that many people use across America have to have some safety standard, you know, that they met before we were allowed to buy them on the market. I don't think we have effective safety standards for social media platforms, even though billions of people are using them around the world. The second thing, though, to remember, John, is that we have a transparency problem here also when it comes to data. And it's important that we know what the data tells us about the degree to which this is harming the mental health of our kids and which kids in particular are most vulnerable, what kind of solutions actually help. We don't have that data. And I believe it is really incumbent, there's a moral responsibility the companies have to share that data with the public so that we understand the full extent of the harms that may be being caused and which kids are most affected. This lack of transparency, lack of safety standards, in my mind, is a profound challenge. And I worry that we will look back on this in 5 years, 10 years, and see our failure to understand fully the impact of social media on our kids in particular, and to address the mental health impact of these platforms as a colossal societal failure.
So that's from episode 81, The Surgeon General Wants Your Boss to Build You a Healthier Workplace. And yeah, I mean, it was refreshing to hear the Surgeon General isn't the president and isn't setting a lot of policy, but still has influence and still at least reflects this idea of thoughts from the government, I guess.
Sure.
And it was refreshing to hear that at least a problem is being recognized. It's also very clear that he is following the advice of Dale Carnegie and using my first name a lot when he talks
yes.
to me.
Yeah. No, he was good. He was good. It's such a fascinating thing that to think that this has become such a real problem, you know, that yeah. for me growing up in high school, it was really awkward to cyberbully someone over AOL Instant Messenger.
It took forever.
And, yeah, boy, it was really lame. And now the Surgeon General is about it, which is a relief to me. I can't imagine what it must be like to be a teenager in today's world. It must be devastation.
Yeah, I mean, I have a hard enough time just on old dad Facebook of like seeing other people on vacations that I wish I was on. But yeah, to be in your formative years, I mean, I'm glad that the Surgeon General is out there at least keeping an eye on things and giving it some thought.
And looking good doing it.
And he's a fine-looking man.
Yeah, he was very well put together.
Just ahead, more of our most memorable episodes on this, the 100th episode of Depresh Mode.
And now, a live reading from Rachel's Poetry Corner.
Elephants Theremin's Clifton, Neopets Porstrips Jepson, Pinesmell Jellybeans Goligoles, Skittles Squirrels and the Mole, Celery Chopsticks Pumpernickel, A Case of You by Joni Mitchell, Lullabies Tie-Dye The More You Know, all of these things on our wonderful show.
All these things and more wait for you on Wonderful every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
It's the 100th episode of Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe, alongside producer Gabe Mara, and we're recalling some of the previous episodes that have really stayed with us.
My final pick, in chronological order, is episode 86, The Whimsy and Depth of Depressed Cake Shop. So Depressed Cake Shop was a thing I found very randomly. You know, when I research guests for the show, I just as often go into Google and type in the word depression and click the news, and sometimes it yields results. And this is one of them. The funny thing is that we don't get many complaints about the show. Almost all of our listeners just really love us. But the one that we get sometimes that kind of bothers me because they're totally right is that we don't talk to everyday people so often. We don't talk to people on the ground floor. We talk to celebrities, which is good for us, which is great for ratings. Yeah. But when we get a chance to talk to normal people who are normal people, that's not a very nice thing to say. When we get a chance to speak to people who aren't, you know, in show business, people who run cake shops, like Sasha Biesi, who you speak to in this clip here, talking about her shop Skull and Cake Bones. It's so real to just hear her talk about how she bakes cakes and sells them to make money for NAMI, which is just wonderful.
You got cookies, you got cupcakes, anything else?
We had sliced cakes. We did macarons that were gray macarons and the center had color in them. The main thing that we focus on is our charcoal lemon scone, because the scone itself is dark gray. And then the frosting is really bright, not bright yellow. It's bright white from the lemon frosting. And you get this real idea of the light and dark of mental illness. And so that's, I would say that's our main baked good that we do.
That's your signature item.
Yeah.
One doesn't ordinarily think of charcoal as a flavor or even an ingredient in a lot of baked goods. How did that come about?
Well, I had this little girl working for me. She was my daughter's age and in my daughter's class. And she started working for me when she was like 15. And I had known her whole entire life. So when we were doing scones, and it was hard to get people out here in the Hill Country to start buying scones. I don't know why, but I was determined to do different flavors of scones all the time. So I said to Beatrice one morning when we were getting ready for the day, I said, I don't really care. Just make up a flavor of scone. And that was what she came up with. She said, can I put charcoal in it? Because at the time we were doing charcoal cake. And she said, can I put charcoal in the scone? And I said, yeah, sure, absolutely. And then we put the lemon on top because that's her favorite. And then when she was almost 16, she suffered with mental health concerns for a really long time. And when she was 16, she took her own life. And so that's why we always do the charcoal lemon scone, because it's really for her. And it was the flavor that she came up with. So even though it's such a random flavor combination, it really works. And it's got a beautiful symbolic story behind it too, I think.
I picked this episode because, like I said at the top, it surprised me. I thought we were going to get like a bouncy, goofy episode about this cute cake shop pop-up thing that people do for fun about depression. And speaking to Sasha, like she shared this story that starts normally and then it sidelines you with the tragedy and beauty of lemon charcoal scones. Yeah. And it makes me smile to think about it, and it also hurts my heart. And it was just really great to just have an everyday life story that, you know, affects everyone of our mental health.
Yeah, it's a tragic story, and there's also so much love in it. That's,
yes,
you know, that there's how she feels towards Beatrice and everything that this girl meant to her, and the ongoing honoring of Beatrice through cake, through this,
yes,
this thing that, you know, is a treat and a fun thing, but also like you deliver joy to people through baked goods. There's this beauty and depth in this story that, like you say, you never expected would be there.
Yes. And if you yourself, listener, want to start your own Depressed Cake Shop pop-up, you can just go to depressedcakeshop.org, and the lovely Valerie will guide you through how to put it together, and you can start baking your gray cupcakes with sad faces on them, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, it's funny, but in a kind of deep way that will surprise you.
Yes.
All right. So my fifth out of five, and this takes us all the way up until like a couple of weeks ago. We did an episode again, and this is somebody who isn't a huge household name. This was
not yet
on her way. This is Casey Davis, episode 96, Household Chores, Struggle Care, and Your Mental Health. And this idea came about from our Preshies group. People were recommending Casey as someone who takes on the subject of household care, the chores you need to do around the house, the hygiene that you need to do for yourself, and how all those things intersect when there's depression involved, when there's anxiety, when there's trauma involved, when there's neurodivergence involved. This is an episode we've been hearing about a lot from people who listen to the show. The term changed my life really has come into play around this episode.
I really spent so much time in my head thinking that, like, when it came to my mental health, I was either doing good or doing bad. And so I began to see things in my life either as proof that I was doing good or proof that I was doing bad. And then I would feel shame about doing bad and have to berate myself into doing something different. And because I was only okay, I only didn't feel the anxiety of worthlessness if I was doing good. So I really try to look at my home and things as just morally neutral. Like they're not about doing good or bad or any of those things. They're just about living. And I just try to keep things functional.
And yeah, Casey laid out these six tenets of her system of philosophy. And that was number one, care tasks are morally neutral. And
yes.
This is something that, like, when I heard that and thought, oh, okay, I can apply that to cleaning the kitchen. I can apply that to all the laundry that I have to get to. But hold on, I can also apply it to relationships I've had and jobs that I've had and family members. And a lot of the things that I get kind of caught up in are actually morally neutral. I'm projecting a morality onto them that makes them necessarily exhausting.
Yes, I am not a bad person for having dirty dishes in my sink. And just having...
Nor are you a good person.
Exactly.
It's just, it doesn't matter.
It's neutral. It doesn't matter. I'm trumping something up that doesn't need to be. And that it's so useful.
It's so useful. It comes in handy all the time. All of her tenets are so solid. Rest is a right and not a reward. You can't save the rainforest if you're depressed. Good enough is perfect. Shame is the enemy of functioning. There's just like, I need to get these things printed out and framed and hung, maybe not above my desk, but maybe in the kitchen.
Yes. Yeah, like on the inside of a cabinet. So you don't have to see it all the time. But when you're reaching for the macaroni.
Right. It's there. Your morally neutral macaroni.
Yes.
Well, Gabe, this has been fantastic. And let's reconvene and do this at episode 200. And,
sounds good.
And get a rundown from that.
It's a pleasure to be your producer, John. It has been and will continue to be so.
The pleasure is all mine. Ever pull an all-nighter? Ever pull 11 all-nighters?
I don't remember sleeping for 11 days. I'm sure I did sleep because the doctor said you can't go 11 days. I was psychotic. The first thing that happens when you go into the hospital and you say, hi, I haven't slept in 11 days, is they go, oh, okay, what drug did you take? I said, I hadn't taken, oh, you know, and I'm like, I haven't. Like, all right, 26-year-old guy in Los Angeles in 19, yeah, I've been awake for 11 days, but I'm not on drugs. Sure. And then they take your blood and then they come back 40 minutes later, ashen faced, going, wait a minute, because then they see there is no drugs in my system. And they come back and they go, how long have you been awake?
Comedian Dana Gould is with us. Remember, my new show, Sleeping with Celebrities, is out now on Maximum Fun. It's a podcast designed to give you mild, relaxing conversation and some laughs as you doze off to sleep. Our latest episode has Depression Mode alum Open Mike Eagle. And on Wednesday, March 15th, we welcome Neil Gaiman, This Is True, who talks us to sleep while talking about sourdough starter and homemade kombucha. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, then fall asleep. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available 24/7 for free in the United States by calling 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available, text the word HOME to 741741. We're on Instagram and Twitter at DepreshPod. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at John Moe. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. Hi, credits listeners. If that show The Last of Us is based on a video game, I see no reason why Ms. Pac-Man shouldn't make an appearance. You know, have a romance with a Pedro Pascal character, eat some fruit and ghosts. It would be awesome. Depression Mode is made possible by your contributions. The show is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things wings out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is Cleo from Australia, and we need you here. Whether you're at your best or your worst, we need you here.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.